House Committee on Agriculture and Land Use, and open a work session on House Bill 2437. Our ag maintenance ditches is finally ready to go, but we need a short explanation on the dash threes, and we have some folks that are going to come
and talk about it.
Talk about it.
Yeah.
So let me open the work session on House Bill 2437 and ask Marianne, Chandra, and somebody else to come up.
Gina.
To come up and talk about these dash threes.
I was just going to say, typically I would not be wearing any sort of paraphernalia up here, but since it's Dairy Farmer Day, and I asked the chair if it was okay.
You did.
And I see a lot of them out there. I figured it was all right, so.
And I ate some ice cream earlier,
and
so.
Had ice cream.
I'm in a good mood.
Chair Clement, members of the committee, for the record, Marianne, we're here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. I think this is a great day for Dairy Day because a lot of dairy farmers rely on drainage ditches to maintain their farms and provide us these wonderful dairy products. So we're very on theme today. Since we were last before you, we've worked very hard, the three of us, Trout Unlimited, Nature Conservancy, and Farm Bureau, to reach consensus on this bill. We've literally spent hours on these amendments, and I really appreciate the time that these two have put into working through their concerns on the bill. Just some broad points. Under this bill, the broad authority still lies with DSL. It allows ODA to administer the program, but enforcement does revert back to DSL if there's non-compliance or if there's a dispute between the agencies, which I will discuss later. And the structure now closely mirrors the existing DSL process, just very streamlined on the landowner side. So there is still, and we'll talk about this, we've added back some ODFNW review and some opportunity for comment that they currently have under the current process. So one of the things that we did, we modified slightly the definition of dry. So the ditch must be dry at the time of cleaning, but it does allow for water that might come back into the channel as the result of the cleaning from groundwater infiltration. We also then did allow a provision that if it is a dry channel all summer, but it rains right before you're about to do your work, that you can call ODA and ODFNW and figure out a process for a variance if the ditch does have a little bit of standing water in it. And so that variance process is a new addition and one that we think will greatly improve the process. But the intention is that this maintenance authorization is only for channels that are dry all summer and into the fall, and not for, you know, waterways that typically have water in them year-round. A few points about the base bill that I've heard some confusion on afterwards. We do expand out and allow drainage districts this authorization. That is because a lot of these districts are solely farmer-run. They don't have staff. They don't have staff, and so they have to submit to ODA jurisdiction to be able to use this authorization, but it does allow for them to use it. And then also to clarify, for the 3,000 cubic yards, it allows for 3,000 cubic yards of removal and then 3,000 cubic yards of placement onto adjacent farmland. But the intent is not that it's somehow 6,000 out of the channel. That's 3,000 out of the channel and then 3,000 that can be placed onto adjacent farmland, which are often qualified as farmed wetlands. So that's why it reads that way. So some of the new provisions, we've removed essential salmonid habitat from the reach of the bill. That was based on concerns from some of the fisheries groups around the importance of ESH for salmon and the need for it to potentially go through a more robust process. So it is allowed for a general permit for DSL to create at a later date, but it is not under this kind of more streamlined authorization. We also said that we can't impact water rights. It doesn't mean you need a water right to clean your ditch. You never have. It just means that you can't modify your ditch in a way that if there is a water right attached to it, that you've impacted someone else's water right or enlarged your own. And we still have to comply with fish passage and other water quality requirements. We actually added a few new conditions based on ODFNW's review of like what they would do if they had gotten this kind of permit through DSL. So that would be a smooth grade on the bottom of the ditch after the activity is complete, and that the person doing the cleaning needs to use existing crossings for the excavator and other equipment that they bring out. The biggest change, I would say, is a new ODFNW review and process. So we've added a level of ODFNW review of the notices. So the landowner will still solely work with ODA, but then when ODA gets the notice, they will transmit it to ODF&W, who will review it and either say it's fine or potentially provide additional recommendations. They can review for both whether they think that the activity actually meets the scope of the authorization. For example, they could raise, we don't really think this is a ditch, or whether any special conditions are necessary for fish and wildlife. So they could say, well, this is a ditch, but there's this really cool species of salamander here, so you need to modify the activity in this way to account for that salamander. So ODF and ODA will then review those conditions, if any, that ODF&W provides. And if ODA agrees, then those are part of the authorization and get sent to the landowner. If ODA were to disagree with ODF&W's assessment, then DSL would make the final decision about what the final conditions need to be. And that is designed to mirror the existing process right now. DSL is the final arbiter of what conditions apply to a fill and removal permit. If the landowner does not hear from ODA within 45 days, they are allowed to proceed. And so there's a 45-day review window for the ODA and ODF&W process. We do allow for expedited review if there is some sort of emergency situation. And we also allow ODA and ODF&W to grant a variance, as I said, from conditions if those conditions are unworkable for a landowner. And again, I'm thinking somebody that has a kind of a unique ditch situation where they may say, well, I don't have an existing crossing, for example. This is what I normally do. Does that work for you? And then we've added, so that it make it very clear, that ODA and ODF&W are able to request a site visit both to see if the ditch meets the authorization, for example, if it's really dry, if it's really a ditch, and also on the back end to assess compliance with the notice to make sure the landowner actually followed the conditions in the review. We also have a strong adaptive management approach where DSL, working with ODA and ODF&W, may by rule change or modify the authorizations after assessing how the program is working, after looking at new science that's developed, and really, I think, just assessing how the ditch cleaning is going and how the projects are actually working. It was very important. I wanted to just get on the record. This new authorization is a new process for landowners who want to use it. It does not change or limit existing exemptions. So if a drainage district or landowner has an exemption or a process that's already been working for them, if they, for example, already have a five-year permit in place, they don't have to be under this new program unless they want to. One thing I did want to flag, because I know it was a big subject of conversation in 2015, we've structured this so the ODF&W is not authorized for cost recovery under that 2015 statute, because it is a new program within ODA, and ODA would have no real means of assessing how much that cost recovery would look like. So we're actually seeking just a direct appropriation to ODF&W based on ODF&W's estimates of the workload associated with this program. I think that's certainly something we can talk about, but it's a little bit of an awkward timing because the program was designed. So most agencies had 2 years to look at what the cost recovery might look like before they had to pay it. And obviously, if we came right into it now, that wouldn't happen with ODA. Agencies may also enter into MOUs to effectuate the program. One of the things that I wanted to get on the record for ODA, just because the wording's, I think it's plenty clear in the bill, but still just an interesting concept. ODA is charged in the MOU outlining a process if a landowner disputes that their ditch is essential salmonid habitat, outlining a process for the landowner to kind of dispute that characterization. The intent is that ODA works with DSL and ODF&W to outline a process for looking at if something is really ESH. The intent is not to give ODA any authority over ESH. The intent is to stay exactly where it is now, but just that ODA is able to communicate to the landowner how they can begin to undertake the process of saying, I don't think I'm ESH, and that has actually happened with a couple of ditches where the ESH map just kind of went in the wrong direction and captured a ditch when it was intended to follow a stream upwards. And then it also mandates that DSL creates a general permit for removal in wet or essential salmonid habitat waterways, but there are sideboards on that authorization. The authorization must protect, maintain, or enhance agricultural ecological functions associated with the channel, utilize best available science, and consult with all relevant state and federal agencies. The intent with that is for a lot of waterways that are also Section 10 waterways, which we have probably learned about in our assumption conversation, that those waterways are often also federally jurisdictional for fill and removal. And so the idea is we do need a streamlined federal permit. And so let's create a process where the state has the authority to kind of work with the feds and hopefully create a streamlined state and federal permit over time for a lot of those coastal waterways and waterways that are wet year round that have been maintained as ditches historically. And then the legislation authorizes OSU to study the benefits and impacts of ditch maintenance, again, with an eye toward looking at adaptive management conditions that we may want to look at over time as this program moves forward.
I want you to understand that we streamlined the process and that we wanted you to hear all the details.
I'm sorry.
Because it's very important for you to understand that we have looked at this upside down, inside out, and backwards. And we've tried to make sure that all partners were there to make sure that we were listening and hearing each other. But I really want to thank Mary Ann. I had her show me her remarks before, and I said, yeah, it's dense, but it's important. So thank you for listening with us, and thank you for presenting.
There was a dress rehearsal. Nicely
not,
done,
not
Madam
really,
Vice
Not really
Chair.
A dress rehearsal, just content, content.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Thank you.
Okay, please.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Gina Carter. I'm from the Nature Conservancy. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments on House Bill 2437. TNC does recognize the challenges facing Oregon's agricultural families, and we're committed to finding solutions like we were working through this bill that allows for robust agriculture while also ensuring fish and wildlife can thrive. Over the past few weeks, we have worked very closely to build on these bill concepts and find solutions. I want to acknowledge the work group co-chairs, Representative McLean and Representative Brock Smith, for their patience and leadership as we work through this process. The Dash 3 does include a lot of important changes that addressed issues that you may have heard in our testimony in January. I actually had a list of them, and I was going to read them, but we realized we're very duplicative in our testimony, so I will not go through all those. But I will say that as we move forward, that the studies that are outlined in Section 10 of this bill are very important. As we discussed numerous times in this process, the science is really weak in this area, and that by doing and collecting the data and doing these studies, it is really critical to the adaptive management process and also to informing whether additional program refinements are warranted for various geographies or habitat types. And with that, I'll just say thank you again for the opportunity to participate in this and for being able to comment today. Thank you.
Hi, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Chandra Ferrari. I'm with Trout Unlimited. Everyone has pretty much said everything I was going to say also, so I'm going to try to keep this really brief. And I just think it's important to note before I get started that when we approached this challenge, it really was through the lens of trying to maintain what we have with the existing program, which is the individual permit process. So these things can happen above the cap of 3,000 cubic yards, right, in ESH habitat now. They just need the individual permit process, which we found to be a little bit unworkable. And so we're like, well, let's see if we can maintain what we have in that IP process in terms of fish and wildlife protection while getting it a little bit more streamlined. And I think we've really accomplished that with the new changes that we have in here. And the important points really are the ODFW consultation, the ability to special condition. And again, we don't expect that to be used that much. We spent a lot of time trying to find all the standard conditions that they have used ever in one of these permits, right? We've included all of those to the extent we can, but we wanted to recognize it just might not make sense every time. Some of these things are unique. They need the ability to say, in this case, maybe we make this tweak here. So we'd be really interested to see the adaptive management come through and say, is this working the way we thought it would, where we really don't expect to see that much use of that special condition. But it's important. We also removed ESH, and again, not because this can't happen in ESH, existing law allows that now, but because we're recognizing that this is an important designation and maybe the time that's associated with the individual permit process might be warranted here. But it'll be interesting to see adaptive management, see if we feel that way after, you know, we've seen iterations come through. So I also want to note, we clarified in adaptive management that we have a goal with changes, and that is all the agencies must consult together on the changes. They must be based on best available science, and they must meet the dual goals of allowing the activity to proceed while protecting and maintaining the existing function that we have. It's a really important piece of the adaptive management and an important piece of what will drive the changes going forward, and that was an important piece to us as well. And then I'll just note that we also support the study. We think it's very critical that it moves forward as well. It's a really key opportunity for us to better understand what's going on out there and determine if there's ways we can incentivize better behavior or if it's, you know, the costs and benefits of what we're doing now, both in terms of economic and ecological outcome. So from TU's perspective, those really were the most important changes that we wanted to bring to the attention of the committee, and we feel really good about where this bill landed. So I thank you for the opportunity, and thank you to Mary Ann and Gina, too. We spent a lot of time together, and it's been very productive.
Okay, questions for this group? Okay, let's have a vote on the dash three, or a motion on the dash threes.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated April 1st, 2019.
Do you want to see Vice Chair McLean moves the dash three amendments dated April 1st, 2019. We're just going to slow walk this a second to see if our colleague is ice creaming it or in a site or something.
Okay. Right back, so I don't know how long that is.
No? No, it's okay. Any discussion on the dash threes? Just don't feel like I can wait any longer. It's been a year of hard work. Well, maybe we'll just make a little moment while we see if she comes back.
Okay. I would love some discussion. I can have some.
Yeah. So, Vice Chair McLean and Representative Rocksmith, I think it's been 10 years of me hearing about conflicts between farmers in DSL, and I really did not expect you were going to be this successful, honestly, when I asked you to do this. And I know it is a tremendous amount of labor involved, and I don't see how we can't mention Laura's assistance either, but there is a moment here that I just want to thank you both for. And particularly Vice Chair McLean, who I know you had to spend almost your entire summer and all your political capital, and we're back, herding this process along and shepherding along, and it's just, you've done a tremendous service to the state here.
So let me please, Mr. Chair, it's all the folks that you just heard speak to the bill, and when you know that you've got a good process is when people are hearing each other, listening to each other, and trying to understand what each other are saying because they want the process to go well. And so they deserve all the credit, and it's just a delight that we get to vote on this today.
Yep, Representative Rocksmith.
And I echo what my colleague has said. Thank you all for all of your great work and countless hours. And it was worth every four-hour trip from the South Coast to come up and work with you all and on the phone. And I thank you, Mr. Chair, for putting the work group together. And for Laura, for all of her great work, because she was amazing in just coordination and putting all the work group information together. And it wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the skilled work of Laura and getting everyone together on the same page. And lastly, Representative McLean, your leadership was something to watch, I have to tell you. And I sincerely appreciate it. I am ecstatic to vote on this bill today.
And we forgot to mention Eric was put in a position right off the bat, I think, to have to defend and work with a long history of relationships. And everybody told me he came at it from such a refreshing perspective to say, look, we don't have to do everything. Could ODA do something? What can we do? How can we make this easier? And sometimes in agency world, it's hard to get assigned to be part of a work group where your turf may realign and not thinking about protecting turf, but thinking about how to make the program more usable and more functional, I think was very helpful, Eric. And so we really appreciate your contributions to the effort. Vice Chair Post.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm just actually afraid that now that we did all that punting, that we may have just jinxed the bill.
The amendments, so
I'm scaring
just get going.
That I just
we,
thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, you talk too much, you jinx things, and it dies in the House. So.
So shut
and
up
I also
and vote,
would like or? To ask Representative Brock-Smith if he would join the guys in solidarity and remove his tie, but that could be another conversation later. Yeah. I know that'd be really hard for you, wouldn't it?
That'd be very awkward. Okay, any further discussion on the dash threes? Any objection to the dash threes? So adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2437 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair McLean moves House Bill 2437 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion? Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be a courtesy yes today.
A courtesy yes. Okay, colleagues, we don't need a roll call vote probably for that. Any objection to the motion?
I would like a roll call for this.
Okay, just for a year's worth of work, let's have a roll call vote.
Representative Bossart-Davis.
Aye.
Representative Helm.
Aye.
Representative Brock Smith.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
Aye.
Vice Chair McLean.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Clinton.
Aye.
Motion passes. The bill's off to Ways and Means, and we are put on our, we can't go home unless this bill gets funded, because it was a lot of work to not get out of Ways and Means. So there's someone from the Speaker's office here. Maybe you could send a little note that if we're really nice on 2003, we'll get our ag maintenance bill out.
Whoa.
Ooh, a little horse trading. Okay. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2438. Okay, we've got some dash four amendments.
Okay, Chair Clem, I move to adopt the dash four amendments dated March 18th, 2019.
Vice Chair McLean moves the dash four amendments dated March 18th, 2019. Do we want to know what those are briefly?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, the dash four amendments consists of two appropriations. One appropriation is from the general fund to the Oregon Cascades West Council of Governments for that public mitigation bank pilot program. The second appropriation is to DSL from the general fund for providing responses to the wetland land use notices received from local governments.
Okay. Any further discussion on the dash fours? Any objection? Seeing none, so adopted.
Representative Clem, I move House Bill 2438 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair McLean moves House Bill 2438 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion?
Sorry.
Any objection? Okay, off to Ways and Means we go. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2003. And we've got,
do you have water?
I do have water.
Okay, yep.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the dash six amendments dated April 2nd, 2019.
Vice Chair Post moves the dash six amendments dated April 2nd, 2019. Colleagues, you'll recall this was the one that we had the discussion on and the helpful little walkthrough from Taylor on the other day. Any discussion? Any objection? Okay, the dash sixes are adopted. You know what might be kind of fun? Do you want me to read it and you can actually chair?
Hold my heart, be still. I don't know what you do.
I'll help you.
Okay.
Chair Post, yes. I move House Bill 2003 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Clem.
Representative Clem moves House Bill 2003 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Speaker's bill. You're about to, it's live or die right now. So we got to do something.
On behalf of the Speaker of the House.
First you say, is there any objection?
No,
good God.
That was my discussion.
Oh,
on behalf of the Speaker of the House, I am proud to ask, is there any objection to this motion?
Oh, no, I'm just kidding. Some levity. Come on, Taylor.
Is this to adopt the amendments or to pass the bill on?
This is the bill.
Okay. I have no discussion. I just want to make sure I know what we're doing.
Okay. Seeing none.
A little extra fun, and I got lost.
Okay. Seeing none, the motion passes, and the measure is sent to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Give me that back. Okay.
That's really bad.
Let me open a work session.
It's my first time.
On House Bill. I'll probably get called in and talked about too about that later.
We're ready.
Okay. Representative Solomon's bill. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2914.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated April 1st, 2019.
Vice Chair Post moves the dash two amendments dated April 1st, 2019. Colleagues, an issue came up. This is the one that had the language was affixed during the House Bill, whatever it was, 4078 in 2016, had essentially fixed in statute permanently that this one particular area of land had to be used for industrial or for employment lands, and this returns back to the city of Hillsborough the ability for them to set what it is. The problem is the map reference was incorrect in the original bill. We were referencing a map from many years earlier that probably Mr. Jillians had sued and was therefore not valid anymore. So this dash two makes a reference to the actual area that's under discussion. That's the dash twos to fix the map. So any discussion on the dash twos?
I'm glad that the dash twos are here because I had said that I think it was 540 acres and now this only covers about 248. I'm still not going to be able to vote in favor of this bill, and I apologize for that, but it's a long story of 35 years in the making.
Okay, so on the dash two part, any objection to the dash twos? Okay. Any other discussion, dash twos, no objections? Okay, dash twos amended, and then the base bill, bill as amended, sorry.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2914 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves the House Bill 2914 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Bossart Davis.
Aye.
Representative Helm.
Aye.
Representative Brock Smith.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
Aye.
Vice Chair McClain.
No.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Clutcher.
Aye. Motion passes. We'll ask Representative Solomon to carry the bill. Okay. Outdoor OMGs. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2790. And colleagues, the dash twos are a merger of the Representative Mike McClain, Representative Smith Warner ingress and egress request, along with some additional parameters around OMGs that will not have as many raves going on in the middle of the night without at least a conditional use permit in my area. It's a fair summary. So,
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated March 28th, 2019.
Vice Chair McClain moves the dash two amendments dated March 28th, 2019. Any discussion? Any objections? So adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2790 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair McClain moves the House Bill 2790 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, motion passes. We will we'll ask Representative Smith Warner if she wants to carry the OMG on her own or if she wants someone else to talk about it with her. But at least Smith Warner can talk about her part. Okay, let me open a public hearing on... A work session on, the livestock districts. Let's get rid of a livestock district. No, let's change the process. House Bill 3365.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 3365 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair McClain moves House Bill 3365 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? And motion passes. Representative Brock Smith, would you like to carry the it's not a special district according to Mr. Landauer, but it is a very special district in the livestock world. So would you carry that?
I would be happy to carry my bill.
Great. Now, we're going to carry cranberries over. So carry over House Bill 2573. A little issue that popped up that we're still working through to the next meeting, which is what, April the 8th? April the 9th. So let me carry over House Bill 2573. Let me open a work session on, let me just look for a second here. House Bill 2061, CAFOs. And colleagues, we've been having additional discussion on this one, and I think we need more discussion on this one. But the way to have more discussion on this, I think in our view, is send it with no recommendation down to Ways and Means, where Representative Brock Smith will be waiting to catch it and talk with Chair Reardon and others about any other ways that we can figure out besides a fee increase right now to get this position or to get this work done and funded. But I think we're not 100% there yet on the method to do so.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt dash one amendments dated March 4th, 2019.
Vice Chair McClain moves the dash one amendments dated March 4th, 2019. And recall, the dash one narrows down significantly what the fee increase would have been. So we'll at least get it down to this point, then send it on to recommendation for further conversation. Any objection to the dash ones? Seeing none, so adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2061 as amended without recommendation as to passage to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair McClain moves House Bill 2061 as amended without recommendation as to passage to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, off to Ways and Means we go. Let me do House Bill, open a work session on House Bill, where is it? This one, R 2796.
You're ready to work either of you.
We have them both, okay.
Yeah, honey, good.
Well, let me open a work session on House Bill 3384. And colleagues, I want to talk about this one for a second because I don't mind doing business in public. It's not a bad thing. So you recall we had Representative Nierman's bill that was regarding the Kings Valley School, who had started a school prior to House Bill 3099, which limited schools on EFU. And then we had the Representative Wilde's bill talking about the Oak Hill School. And so what I'm interested in is, can we solve both these problems at once? And so for our discussion, we don't actually have to make a decision today, but I would like us to discuss it. I've got these dash twos that are taking the date of January 2009 off for when you needed to owned the, so the requirement is you owned the school before January 1, 2009, and also any of the land you would expand to is also a sideboard. And the Oak Hill School, for example, they're okay either way. They got caught up under a different situation, which the bill would resolve. But the Kings Valley, and I think maybe others, some of the land they owned was after 2009. And so the public policy question we're trying to deal with is, once we stopped the creation of urban schools on farmland, what about the ones that were already there, and could they expand? And I think that's probably some of the Hood River schools, and that's some of the maybe Ben Lapine schools. And do we have an interest in trying to either stop the expansion by acquisition of new land, or limit the expansion to some amount? This just says if you had the school before January 1, 2009, and if we adopt the dash twos, you could keep buying land still, and then expanding to the extent your school wanted to expand. And so the question that, again, we don't have to vote today, I just want us to talk about for a minute, is it in the state's interest to try and limit the expansion, or will just the natural size of the school can only expand so much anyway before it gets too big and too unwieldy and too not enough people live in the area? In the future, we definitely wouldn't have more schools built that were primarily serving urban places, but we're still trying to figure out how to deal with these maybe 10 or so schools that are in EFU that would not be able to expand unless we change that date. Vice Chair McClain.
Well, I'm having trouble with this bill just the way it's written, because I think you just brought up what's important, and that is, why are, you know, if we're going to limit something, what is the reason for the limit, and are we using the right tool? Now, there are two of these types of schools out in the Hillsborough School District, and there's a difference between Lapine and Hillsborough and where this Oak Hills school sits. Even the one in Dallas you know, a different community? Is it urban? Is it rural? Where does the school sit and who is it serving? There are some that are drawing a lot of kids from farther away. Some of that has to do with distance and travel. But some of these are in urban areas in the Willamette Valley that it's not so much about no school. There are other choices for school, and for whatever reason, they're choosing to drive, you know, over 80 miles to take children to that school. And so, I mean, there's a lot of issues there. And so I really appreciate the fact that you are trying to figure out, again, do we have the right tool? Does the right tool help these two schools? And is the reason that we're doing it for the right reason? Or because if you're saying we shouldn't have new schools, well, there was a reason for that. Because we were using exclusive farm use land, and we were trying not to encourage these public uses, especially if it wasn't for rural folks in a rural area. So I just think there's a lot of issues there that are worthy of conversation. So whatever you can do to help us have that conversation would be great.
The one thing I've been thinking about that's not addressed in the amendments is maybe there is some threshold at which you're functionally just building a whole nother school that you would not be allowed to. Mm-hmm. So maybe we say something like, you know, if it gets bigger than 33% of what its current size is, that's enough. And at that point, you should probably go build another school, something like that. It's not an amendment we have at the moment, but, you know, at the time when we were doing this, we were not really trying to affect the current existing schools. But I can see we obviously did affect some of the current existing schools by putting that January 1 date for acquisition of land. President Bossart Davis.
What is the, whether it's existing law or whether this is passed, what would be the local, because like Representative McLean said, Hillsborough is different than Lapine is different than what we're talking about with Oak Hill. So what's the local jurisdiction's responsibility or even availability to do anything either now or if this passes?
So the key difference between Representative Wilde's bill and the Nearman bill, disallowed any conditional use permits from being allowed to be put on, and Wilde's bill, even with the dash twos, would still allow conditional use permits. And so then a county could say, yeah, they can expand, but only under these conditions, only under these times. And so that's one other option, is we don't try and figure out what's fair for expansion. We just leave it up to the counties through the conditional use permit process to say what the conditions would be of their expansion, and we don't try and guess at that.
And were we, but, I remember, Mr. Chair, thank you, being uncertain that the folks represented by Rep. Nearman didn't have other options at the local level. I remember being skeptical that they hadn't gone through the local process yet, and then we're coming directly to Gus because they thought it would be easier.
And I said I was going to call Benton County.
Okay.
Laura called Benton County, of course, and then wrote a really great memo summarizing it all, which is a pattern of me doing no work and asking other people to do it all. So here's what Benton County came back and said. They said there's two concerns with Kings Valley. One is that it is not necessarily primarily serving rural families, that it is they would consider it a non-conforming use because its population primarily comes from urban areas. And then you may recall that about half the students, even the testifier said about half come from other places. Now, one of the problems is it's right on the border of three different districts. So there are kids from only 2 miles away from the school that are considered out of district who are coming to that school. And if you call Philomath urban, for example, then they would also be considered primarily an urban part when you're doing the calculation. The other part was the January 1, 2009, to go onto a parcel that's contiguous, they had to be owned before January 1, 2009. So this bill would fix the this amendment would fix the January 1, 2009 issue. It would not change the test for urban and rural schools, but I'm actually not sure that the Benton County Community Development Director has this right, because the 2009 statute is what put in the test for whether they were primarily urban or rural. This school was built prior to that, when public schools were just an outright use. And so their expansion wasn't tied to whether they're primarily urban or rural. The expansion was in a whole nother section that said pretty much anybody under this chapter can expand as long as they own their land. But that test of whether they can expand or not isn't on the rural or urban portion. It was on the, it's on the whether you can still be an outright use or not. And so I don't think number one is as big of an issue as Benton County thinks it is, but it could be. They may still have an issue with Benton County.
This bill kind of fixes it because this is not like a private school. Remember, notwithstanding, it's only allowed under those jurisdictions. This may address it.
The fabulous Laura reminds me that there's a notwithstanding clause in here that would make it clear that any local zoning ordinance or regulation, including all their buildings, would become allowable for expansion. So Kings Valley would definitely get to expand, which in their case, I think they were actually talking about an extra classroom and maybe where they put their septic field. And I think that was about it. So I think what I will do is carry this over till Tuesday, and we can talk a little bit more about, for example, whether we should put some up to 33% of their footprint or their current square footage limitation on it or not. But for the Oak Hill folks, do not worry. We will definitely get your bill out. Don't panic. There's one of them right there. We will get your bill out. But for now, I appreciate the conversation. Unless there's any more on this, I will carry over the House Bill 3384 to April 9th, Tuesday, April 9th. Okay, last but not least is degraded wetlands. So let me open a work session on House Bill 2796. And now I've forgotten what the dash one amendments are, but I want to have discussion on the bill too, because we've had some late concerns brought up that I want to talk about. Yeah, can you tell us what the dash ones are?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, the dash one amendments allows for DSL to change, so suspend, modify, or revoke any rule that would allow general permits or general authorizations for this function for the purpose of obtaining authority to issue or administer a permit under the Clean Water Act. So this is in reference to the S404 assumption bill. If that were to pass, DSL could then change this rule as needed.
So one of the discussion points we've had since we talked about this bill was as it relates to the assumption bill, you need to be in compliance with all federal law or federal policies need to match or be stronger than the federal one. Otherwise, you can't assume. And DSL mentioned that this particular, I think it's probably the mitigation ratio is the part that would make it not, it would make it weaker than federal law on mitigation requirements. So therefore, this would inhibit assumption, which on another day, we're talking about a bill related to assumption. And so this amendment says, okay, if we end up assuming, doing assumption, then this bill sunsets. That way it would not be in conflict with assumption. But in the meantime, it would be in effect. And so before we vote on the amendment, we can just talk about the larger issue too. And Representative McClain, you may want to lead us off, but this has to do with you know, wetlands that are inside UGBs that we're trying to figure out housing solutions for without pushing out the UGBs, but there are some risks of building on wetlands, even degraded or not, that you want to speak to.
Well, who doesn't want affordable housing and who doesn't want us to use land inside of the UGB? You know, not me. But I just want to make sure that we're not leaving ourselves open or leaving others open for more issues and some considerations that maybe we should be talking about before we actually pass this bill. One of them is the term degraded wetland. Now that's a term that I don't really know what that means. I don't have a definition for it. I don't have a go-to as far as what that means or if there's any kind of statute or any kind of language out there that is an equivalent that we have some knowledge or understanding of. Also, I've been receiving letters that are talking about some of the issues that could happen because, of course, we have to remember even if it's a degraded wetland, it is a wetland. And so I know that, you know, if you're going to build on it, you're going to fill it. But there are still some issues out there that I don't know if we've fully discussed. So I was just hoping that we could have a conversation. We want to protect property owners and landowners and businesses and people who would be in these houses and make sure we know what we're talking about. So that's just something to start off the conversation.
Okay, so any other from the committee? And we have some people in the audience who'd probably like to comment too, so we may ask a few people to come up. Representative Bossart Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any idea how many acres or how much we're talking about that would change the classification to be able to build on? Are we talking, do we have any idea?
This is small.
Any DSL knowledge on this question? Eric's going to at least take a stab or tell us. He'll have to get back to us.
Yeah, Chair Clint, members of the committee. No, actually, Eric Metz, Department of State Lands, and go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, Dana Hicks, Department of State Lands.
That's one of the issues. Chair Clem, is that we don't have a definition for it, and so we don't know how to map it, and we can't quantify it.
For degraded wetlands?
Right. Where did it come from, then?
I think maybe Mr. Honeycutt's going to have to come tell us where the definition that we have came from.
Where did the actual two words come from?
I think him.
There is a current definition in our rules, Oregon Administrative Rules, that does have a definition for degraded wetlands. We utilize that currently in rule for wetland enhancement as mitigation. It's a requirement that it have some form of hydrologic degradation, and that is where the definition that is in the bill comes from.
Do you need me, Mr. Chair?
Did you say rule four?
Administrative rule.
Administrative rule four?
Yes, it's in our Division 85 rules.
So one of the other questions then, since you have people.
Yep.
So one of the other questions is the size of this particular wetland, degraded wetland, because the federal rules only apply at certain, is it like 1%? I've read something about that, I'm not sure. But is the size of it a positive as far as being able to follow all the federal laws because it's smaller or not?
So in Oregon, under the current requirements, both with the Clean Water Act and with the removal fill law, both the Army Corps of Engineers and DSL have a permitting process. And if this bill were to pass, it would be in conflict with the federal requirements because they're not allowed to go below a 1 acre for 1 acre ratio. And okay. So that's what a person means. Would be needing to mitigate differently for the two different permits.
So the purpose of this bill, though, is to give an exception. Is that it?
Well, there's two parts to it. One is to have DSO try to make a more streamlined process for doing this kind of work, and then the other is changing the ratio so it makes it more affordable, because one of the concerns about one-to-one mitigation is if it's whatever, $58,000 an acre, it's harder to do affordable housing projects at that cost. You know, in a market environment, maybe you can get it back, but not if you're trying to reduce the project cost overall. So 4-to-1 cuts it down to whatever a quarter of 58,000 is. I'm not so good at math.
That's where I was confused, because the federal law, I mean, if we have to do more than the federal law to meet the federal law, right? We have to do either what the federal law says or do more.
As stringent,
we can do more.
Or more protective.
So, but we're actually taking it the other way.
Correct.
Okay.
Representative Helm.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out, if I remember correctly, was this the fellow from Sheridan? Is this related to the...
refresh us on the whole reason for this bill in the first place. Actually, that'd probably be good.
Chair Clem, Representative Helm, Chair Clem, Dave Honeycutt, Oregon Property Owners Association here on 2796. Yes, Representative Helm, this was a Sheridan problem. And the reason for this bill is because as we worked, and this is not a wetlands working group bill, but as we worked through the wetlands working group, what we discovered was that there were a number of cities and small cities in the Mid-Willamette Valley that have lands in their buildable lands inventory, and really almost all of their lands that are composed of hydric soils, which could conceivably be considered wetlands, Mr. Vorosky's example being one of those. When we don't have enough mitigation banks in the state, and particularly in the valley, and the mitigation banks are done on a watershed basis. So in the case of Sheridan, Mr. Vorosky's mitigation bank is the Mud Slough Mitigation Bank, and so Sheridan competes with McMinnville for use of those mitigation credits. In McMinnville, the average house sells for approximately $450,000. In Sheridan, it's a fraction of that. And so for smaller cities, if the developers have to purchase those mitigation credits, the projects don't pencil out. And as Mr. Vorosky's letter, I think, demonstrated very well, along with the city of Sheridan's letter in support of this bill, without something like this bill, something like it, they can't build housing. They're basically stuck, which is why we haven't seen a new development approval in Sheridan for quite some time. And Mr. Vorosky is attempting to develop this property to build housing that fits the employment profile of the company that Business Oregon just spent a couple of years getting to site in Sheridan. And so he's trying to build housing so that the people that live, that work at the plant can live in the houses right by it. And so it's, as I said in my testimony, I've worked with Eric on this, and I don't have any qualm or objection to DSL on this at all, but we couldn't find a solution beyond. And so this bill is our attempt, while we deal with the assumption, which is going to take quite some time, to try and get something going without getting in the way of the assumption work that we hope gets done in 2436.
Okay. Further questions? Peggy, I bet you would like to come up and talk, wouldn't you?
Me?
Yeah. We need to hear the other side, the concerns. We have a letter that's not League of Women Voters, but lots of other fine people, but hopefully you can give voice to some of your concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. I hadn't expected to be able to speak, but as I did last time, our concern has to do with the fact that, as I understood from DSL, there is a limited definition of degraded wetlands. This is not just for this one site, but it does open the door and creates new policy and new definitions, which would take new rulemaking. You're already asking this agency to do a great deal this session, and I know that I have been contacted by a number of people related to the wetlands issues, who I suspect you have heard from, who have more expertise than I do on wetlands, and who have shared their big main concerns about this bill. So I'm not sure what I can add to the conversation, except that we really think this is not timely, and be happy to figure out. I know that the developer from Sheridan actually applied for the governor's regional accelerator money for housing. Unfortunately, Fox River, the employer, was not willing to step up and say, I'll provide a little bit in order for that to qualify under the governor's regional accelerator program. And that program, by the way, is expected to move forward this session for another opportunity for people. So it's not as if we're not looking for a way to help make this happen in this particular case in Sheridan in some way, but to actually have a change in our wetlands legislation, our wetlands rules for one piece of property is concerning. So be happy to continue to work, but we ask that this bill not be passed this session.
Okay, questions for Peggy? I think maybe I need DSL back up here for a second. So I'm reading the letter that came in from some other folks. This one is the Wetlands Conservancy, and they talk about, for example, increasing vulnerability to earthquake damage and elevated health risks, buildings constructed on or near wetlands, and imposing, just future costs on people if they don't know if there may be a frequent maintenance and elevated disease burden. So as your view of your rule defines degraded wetlands, are those realistic concerns, or if you, I guess, fill them in enough, you can make them stable? Because the concern, I mean, they're talking about liquefaction zones in an earthquake, but, you know, are we in these mid-Willamette Valley cities or on hydric soils, are what we might consider degraded wetlands that dangerous of sites to be building on if you do the proper amount of fill?
Excuse me, Representative Clem, members of the committee, I have not read the letter that you're referring to. I wouldn't say that is a broad assumption that there would be those issues on every wetland that is maybe going to be covered under this bill. So, like I said, I haven't read it in detail, but I wouldn't assume that's a broadly applied across the state.
And how do you view the way the bill, it's, I'm trying to figure out how mandatory and how permissive it is. It says DSL shall evaluate and establish rules, which means you're obviously going to have to spend some money, and hence the subsequent TWIP ways and means for rulemaking, to allow for removal fill activities affecting degraded wetlands. Do you feel like your hands are tied to where you couldn't make a rule that for safety reasons prohibited it based on the way the bill's written? Or could you take that into consideration in a rulemaking? If the goal is to essentially get a general permit to make it easier and then a 4-to-1 ratio, do you think you can do that and still factor in safety in your rules of parameter sideboards around the wetlands? Or is the bill too strict in the way it's written currently to allow you that flexibility in rulemaking?
Representative Clem, I don't believe that the language in the bill would restrict us from considering a multitude of factors that mm-hmm. could be built into the rules to enact the legislation. So we had submitted testimony or a letter on behalf of the department, and our concerns are outlined in there. So that was prepared for the public hearing on March 21st. So those really outline what DSL's concerns and limitations that we see that the legislation would have. We didn't specifically talk about anything to do with earthquake zones or liquefaction risks or anything to that effect.
What was that hearing date you just said? I'm sorry.
March 21st. It was for the public hearing on March 21st, yes.
Okay. I have one too.
Okay. Bill Ryan's letter?
Yeah.
Got it.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, we definitely, the dash ones are aimed at his number 3. Okay, well, I think for the sake of my committee's patience, which has been very good, we will carry over House Bill 2796 till Tuesday, and we can have a little more conversation in between time. And
you've carried over all these if you want to summarize.
Okay, I'm going to say again what we're carrying over just so we don't lose anybody. House Bill 2573, work session carried over. That's related to the Cranberry dwellings. House Bill 2796, we just talked about, carried over. The degraded wetlands issue. And House Bill 3384, school expansions on EFU issue. And those three are carried over. And with that, we will see you for a final day of activity, April 9th. And then the plan is we take April 11th off.
Nice.
We are planning on hearing from Senator Courtney about Senate Bill 2 on April 9th. In addition to our work sessions, we're going to hear about a very interesting and important Senate bill coming up. Always entertaining to hear Senator Courtney talk, period. So look forward to April 9th, and thank you all for your time and attention.
Thank you.